supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Hey, for all of you interested in politics, I have one question. What is a bump? Anyway, Barack Obama received one after his victory in the Iowa caucus, while Huckabee's numbers didn't shift much. But what are those bumps? They're numbers, really. But as a psychologist, I see what's at play here is people's thinking being affected by people's thinking. So how do politicians take advantage of this group psychology? So who do you like? More important, why? And what would it take to change your thinking, even your party? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests today are Diana Muntz and Howard Levine. Howard is an associate professor of political science and psychology at State University of New York in Stony Brook. He's the co-editor of the Journal of Political Psychology. Howard, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
Diana Muntz is a professor of political science and communications at Penn. She's also director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. Diana, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
Howard, before we talk about politicians, let's talk about voters. It seems that over the years, we've become more partisan in our politics. For example, I know lots of people that would never vote for a politician who supports a woman's right to choose. On the other hand, I also know lots of people who have never even watched Fox News, let alone would consider someone who's a Republican. Are we, in fact, more rigid, and why?
Well, I think the popular perception is that we are. Certainly at the elite level, we are, so that the Democrats and Republicans in the House and Congress are more unified. Whether, in fact, that's even true at the mass level is disputed, and there are some pretty good studies suggesting that that's beginning to happen, but is far less the case, at least at present, than I think the popular stereotype suggests. Certainly the Clinton and Bush presidencies have been the most polarizing that we've seen in a long time, but there appears to be, you know, a certain amount of dissatisfaction with the level of polarization to whatever extent it exists in the mass public, and that may be why, in fact, Obama is doing so well.
Well, Diane, it does seem that there are more undecided voters in this election than maybe than ever before. Why does it take voters so long to decide? Is it about careful research or ambivalence, and what are the implications of all these?
I think you really hit on it, Dan, when you talked about perceptions in your introduction, because in a primary period like we're in the midst of right now, the differences among various Democratic and among various Republican candidates are not nearly as pronounced as they are by the fall election, where, you know, we have one Republican and one Democrat and so forth. So during a primary season, the voters who are having opportunities to voice their views in the early primary states and caucus states, they're really not just thinking about where the candidate stands on this issue or that issue. They're also thinking about whether or not the candidate that they like the best has a chance of winning the nomination, and then whether or not they have a chance of being elected in the fall, whether or not they would run well against the other party's candidate. So it makes a lot of sense for them to think about how other people are thinking, as you put it.
Well, let's talk about this business of electability. This has been a major issue so far in this primary. We've got three issues going on here across both parties. We've got the religious issue that comes up with both Huckabee and Romney. And with the Democrats, we've got the obvious race and gender. So how do these affect electability, and that seems to have been shifting over the last couple of weeks?
I think there's been a lot of discussion of whether or not America would elect a Mormon, would elect a woman, would elect an African American, and so on and so forth. But again, that all takes place at perceptual level. That is, people trying to make their best guess about how other people are going to act. And, you know, we know from the literature on political psychology that we're notoriously pretty bad at knowing what drives other people and what they will and will not be willing to do and so forth. And I think part of what we're seeing happen now since the Iowa caucuses is really a big change in the perception of that Americans had of whether or not, for example, Obama was potentially not just electable but also viable as a candidate for the Democratic primary candidacy. So,
can you give us, or maybe Howard, either of you, specifics about what happens in one's mind? A friend of mine told me this past weekend, this is after the Iowa caucuses, he said prior to the caucuses, he thought that Obama was not electable. And now he thinks maybe he is. But What really changed?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, I think. I mean, the decision about for whom you're going to vote is a strategic decision. That is, you don't want to waste your vote on someone who really doesn't have a chance. But beyond that, this is sort of prevalent in all aspects of our life. If, you know, if all of our friends tell us that new restaurant down the street is really lousy, is it really rational for us to say, no, we need to go there ourselves and find out? I mean, we take cues from other people about what is and isn't going to be a good choice. And I think we do that in the political realm as well.
Howard,
you know, let me just jump in and add that I think, I think the stereotype of Clinton and Obama, respectively, before the Iowa caucuses was that Clinton was more electable, and she polled a good deal more electable than Obama did. But I think Obama is a candidate that generates a great deal more enthusiasm, and Democrats have put up with, for lack of a better word, candidates over the last several election cycles that they have not been terribly enthusiastic about. Mondale, Dukakis, Gore, and Kerry, perhaps the best example of all. And I think this gave Democrats, following the Iowa caucuses, some, greater freedom to allow their enthusiasm toward Obama to be expressed. And I think, as well, many primary voters, who remember what happened, in 2004, where Dean was, the candidate, the insurgent candidate who generated more enthusiasm, but Kerry ultimately prevailed because he was perceived as more electable. And, the Democrats got burned on that strategy, and so they may be rethinking, the dimensions of electability, versus enthusiasm.
Well, you bring up something when you talked about Howard Dean, and I want to talk about a pivotal moment in an election. I mean, Howard Dean's pivotal moment was his bark, and there have been pivotal moments in a variety of elections, or arguably Huckabee's pivotal moment in one of the debates when somebody said to him, "What would Jesus say?" And his comment, when he said, "Well, Jesus would be smart enough not to run for politics," it didn't answer the question, but it was in some levels brilliant and showed his humanity and his lightness of being, and I think it shifted perceptions. So how does one find these pivotal moments, and what happens when they get dumped on you by somebody else, like being called a flip-flopper?
I think I would withhold judgment about these pivotal moments. I think they get played up a lot in the news media, and yet often when we go back and, a year later are carefully looking at our election data among academics and so forth, we'll find that that wasn't a pivotal moment at all, even though it's widely believed to have been a pivotal moment. So I guess, when we seize upon something like that and the press makes a big deal out of it, it's easy to believe that somehow that changed everything. And yet, in many of these cases, there's really not a lot of evidence to support that.
Howard, tell us about momentum. I mean, it really does affect what happens to a candidate and what happens to the election, but I don't know what it is. I mean, I'm a sports fan, and I watch momentum in sports, and it's a real phenomenon, but I don't quite know what it is.
Let me just respond to the question about pivotal moments, and then try to answer your question about momentum. You know, there are, I think, cases in which there truly are pivotal moments, and just to perhaps raise two, both in advertising context. In the 1988 election, Dukakis was 20 points ahead of George Bush, and the Willie Horton ads that were run in late September and early October really changed that election. I mean, I actually had another moment in that election when Bernard Shaw asked Mike Dukakis if his wife, Kitty, were raped and murdered, would he then support the death penalty? And, his response was so miserable that, he essentially, began to be seen, in much more negative terms. And, the Swift Boat advertisements in 2004, which Kerry failed to respond to for 2 weeks, also, I think, were the foundation turning around, that particular election. Kerry basically never caught up in the popular polls. So I think that there are moments, and I agree with Diana that, typically the media, hype those moments in such a way as to make them more salient and perhaps to give them greater weight, whereas they may not have been weighed.
And before we go to the momentum issue, let's go to the phones, because we've got sure. Anthony on the line who wants to talk about pivotal moments. Anthony?
Good afternoon, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two pivotal moments for me with respect to Mike Huckabee were comments that he recently made. The first comment with respect to Iran, he said that his strategy for Iran would be to bankrupt them before he bombed them, which I think sort of begs the question that the next thing he'd do if bankruptcy didn't work was to bomb them. So I think he's making statements that sort of indicate his position is to elongate and prolong our involvement in foreign wars. The second comment that he made with respect to Iraq was that we shouldn't go to war with the army we have, but we should go to war with the army we need. And he said that all military decisions should be made by commanders in the field with blood on their boots and medals on their chest. I mean, to me, that fanaticism and creation of fear in terms of psychology, it's a very successful psychology because it plays to society's overall feeling of instability with respect to terrorism.
Well, let me ask you something about your psychology, if I may, or your political psychology. Did you like him before you heard that, or were you ambivalent about him before?
I didn't like him before, but I think that based on what I've read, he did do a few good things as governor of Arkansas. But when I read that, I know that he's speaking to a particular audience. But to me, that just treats the voter as a sheep, herd the sheep with fear, and I totally resent it. I think it's basically a follow up of what we're living with now with the Bush administration, and there's just no way I could pander to that. I would submit to that kind of pandering.
All right, Anthony, I appreciate your call. Thank you. So, Howard and Diana, we're talking about a moment that changed one person, and I guess there are moments, though, that change the direction of the election.
Well, I think that's the difficult thing, especially in right now, which is for most Americans very, very early in the process. This isn't a point in time when everyone has tuned into the election because, most of us don't even have an opportunity to express our views for quite some time, and the whole field of candidates will look different by then. And I think, what this caller suggested is a level of, intense scrutiny and great interest in the political process that isn't the norm. And I think that's the difficulty of having single things at this point in time be pivotal moments, is that, you've got to have a large number of people paying attention to them for them to be pivotal moments. Yet, in a primary that takes place in a small state, it doesn't have to affect that many people. That is, you can have pivotal moments for the voters of New Hampshire by simply influencing 1,000 people, which isn't, a huge number at all.
Diane, before we take our break, you had said when we spoke to you before the show, you made a comment about perhaps explaining why the turnout is so low in elections and why people are less interested than we would like them to be.
Well, I'm not sure this so much explains why, but I think it is a perspective that we don't often think about. That is, we do a lot of tisking to the American voter and telling them that they are bad because they're not voting often enough or learning about the issues and so forth. And one of the things that we don't always think about is the sheer number of decisions that we ask American voters to make. If you look at the number of ballots we cast and the number of political decisions that if we did vote regularly, we might make in a lifetime, we can, in a single election, cast more, or make more, you know, independent decisions about elected officials than someone in Canada will make in their entire lifetime. So we do ask a whole lot of people if we're asking them to truly be, you know, like Anthony, following things that closely and making decisions based on all the candidates' speeches and so forth. Again, at this point in the process, we're not all being asked to vote. People in a very small number of states are paying close attention, but not so much the rest of the country.
Let's take that aforementioned break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about one of the differences between 2004 and now, and Anthony touched on it when he talked about fear, and he resents being made afraid, which is, I think, what 2004 is about, and that seems to be a shift here. We're talking about politics. What influences our decisions? What role do advertising play in our minds, and what role does other people's thinking play in our perceptions of who we like and who we don't like? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Diana Mutz and Howard Levine. Levine is an associate professor of political science at State University at Stony Brook. He's the co-editor of the Journal of Political Psychology. Mutz is a, among other things, director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the hidden fees in your cable, phone, electric, and credit card bills with Bob Sullivan, author of the book Gotcha Capitalism. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Politics. Who do you like and why do you like them? And what would it take to change your mind? Who has turned you on during the primaries and who has turned you off? My guests are Diana Mutz and Howard Levine. Howard Levine is Associate Professor of Political Science up at State University in Stony Brook. He's co-editor of Journal of Political Psychology. Diana Mutz is a professor of political science and communications at the University of Pennsylvania, and she runs the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Howard, we did a political show right before the 2004 election, and my guest said that fear had a great influence on political decision-making. The greater the fear, the more likely we are to clutch our belief systems and become rigid. And as fear increases, so does our belief system become more narrow and regressed. We begin to think about good and evil, black and white in our thinking. And 2008, that's less of an issue now. There seems to be less of a threat going on here, and we're more worried about other things.
Well, let me address two aspects of that. Let me disagree about whether, you know, the 2008 election is one, you know, less characteristic of fear. There are a number of indicators, I think, that suggest people are afraid or should be, or, you know, that threat is likely to play a role in the election. You know, there's a continuing war on terror. We're involved in two wars. There's the specter of Iran. Immigration is an issue that, at least on the Republican side, that I think is generating a certain amount of fear and threat. And certainly we are, there is some probability that the economy will go into recession. Now, the consequences, however, of fear, I think, are slightly more complex. I think the notion that, you know, fear, you know, instigates, you know, more, you know, narrow thinking, you know, is, you know, probably, you know, contained within a segment of the electorate, those voters who are high in the trait of authoritarianism, as they tend to be submissive to authority and especially aggressive toward outgroups, but only when threat in the political environment is high. You know, depending upon the locus of threat, it also, you know, might cut, you know, against, you know, an incumbent, which would be the threat of, you know, economic recession, or it may play into, you know, the perceived strengths and weaknesses of the parties. You know, for the moment, the Democrats, you know, are, you know, perceived as performing better on, you know, even issues that the Republicans typically own. But, you know, if that, you know, sort of returns to its typical equilibrium, you know, fear and threat are tools, you know, that, you know, each party, you know, may use to their advantage.
Well, is it just me? It does feel like the sort of Damocles was over our heads in 2004, and it just doesn't feel that way now. I know there are real threats out there, but I'm not hearing "elect me or your life could be in danger," and I was hearing that in 2004.
Well, you know, Rudolph Giuliani has, you know, explicitly made that point that if you you know, elect a Democrat, you know, very bad things will happen. He ran a couple of ads suggesting, you know, exactly that. You know, if you look at 2006, I think, you know, threat, especially from the war in Iraq, was exceptionally high, and you know, the war is going at least as far as, you know, fatalities, you know, both to Iraqi civilians and to American service personnel, you know, are much lower, and, you know, I think that is, you know, diminishing the impact of fear and threat coming from that particular issue. But, you know, look, I mean, economic recession is becoming, you know, more and more of a possibility, and that typically is a very salient threat to voters, and, you know, typically leads to, you know, the incumbent party or candidate, you know, having a difficult time.
Well,
yeah, I would agree that a lot is going to depend on, you know, what's on the front pages of the paper. I think, you know, right before Iowa, when Benazir Bhutto's assassination news hit, all of a sudden there was sort of a shift to more attention to foreign affairs, and the candidates who are good at talking about foreign affairs undoubtedly benefit from that. And these candidates are, even candidates of the same party, have very different perceived strengths and weaknesses in terms of the issues that, you know, reality aside, where they're perceived to be especially competent. And I think, you know, when those kinds of things are on the table right in front of you and a big concern, that's really going to influence things a lot more than it might otherwise, because there are minor differences in other respects.
You use that word a lot, and it sounds like that's the key word, and that's perceive. How do we perceive? Why do we perceive? And how do people manipulate perception? David Brooks wrote recently in the New York Times editorial, he described how Mitt Romney has crafted his political persona to appeal to various conservative constituencies. And Hillary Clinton's gotten the same rap. So the question is, how does one use maybe valuable, important data from polling and still hold on to one's identity?
Well, that is a difficult thing to do, and, you know, for this particular group of Republican candidates, you know, it is especially difficult, and there, you know, part of that may be that the Republican coalition of economic and social conservatives is really collapsing, right? There, you know, Romney perhaps, you know, singularly represents, or would like to represent, you know, both social and economic wings of the Republican Party. Clearly, Huckabee and Giuliani, are mistrusted by the economic and social wings of the party, respectively. And Ron Paul, is a libertarian, and so there really is, a lot of the Republican field is just, unsettled with respect to, whether one set of issues or the other, will predominate. As voters, continue to judge the candidates.
And of course, it has been argued that the best way to settle down Republicans and to energize them is to nominate Hillary Clinton.
And that, still may be the case. She's having a much more difficult time. I think it's not just, momentum, but, there are just structural predicaments, related both to her gender and to the fact that, she is, she's tethered to the partisan squabbles of the 1990s, and, therefore she's not perceived, as an authentic, agent of change. Change appears to be the lucrative word, in both parties' primaries.
I was going to say to what the data I've seen seem to suggest echoes very much what a lot of the discussion among political insiders, that although, Hillary did have the viability on her side, that is, she was for a long period of time in this process perceived to be inevitable as the Democratic nominee, that really her opponents have been able to capitalize on fears about her electability in the fall, and that is, she's a very polarizing political figure. She has very high positives, but she has really strong negatives, too. And, the hope of the Republicans is that she would be easier to beat than another Democratic opponent would be. Again, it's hard to know this far in advance whether that would ultimately turn out to be the case or not, but certainly there's data out there that backs up that kind of concern about her being highly polarizing, even among many Democrats.
That was Diana Mutz talking. She's a professor of political science and communications at Penn. She runs the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. We're also talking with Howard Levine. He's an associate professor of political science at the State University at Stony Brook. We're talking about politics. Our number is 888-477-9499. Why do you like who you like, and what would it take to change your mind about who you like, even change your party? Give us a call at 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Allison on the line. Allison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Gottlieb.
Sure.
Yes, my comment was actually, I have not been following the candidates very closely, just listening to segments on NPR, but my concern is I am an atheist. And I feel that most of the candidates are focusing so intently on religious beliefs, and I know there are more atheists out there than myself, and I feel like we kind of get overlooked. And I feel that, though I know, obviously your faith can be a basis for your decision-making, but I feel like it's too strongly focused on in campaigns especially. And I would rather see candidates focus on what they're going to do when they get into office rather than what their beliefs are right now, especially concerning their religion.
So if I can ask, so far, who do you like and why?
I do lead towards the Democrats. I think they actually steer away from religion more than Republicans do, obviously, especially Mike Huckabee being a Southern preacher, obviously his religious beliefs are going to affect him greatly in this campaign, but I think as of right now I lean towards either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama.
And is that the central thing that is going to sway your opinion?
Absolutely. Like I said, in a country where we're supposed to be separated from church and state, I feel that, that should be a focus, is that, everyone has their different religious beliefs, including atheists. I mean, even though I don't believe in a supreme being, I do feel that I lead a spiritual life of goodness. And I feel that anyone who doesn't focus on religious beliefs would win my vote.
All right. So here's what I want. I'm going to turn to you, Diana. So I'm going to run for president here, and I want Allison to vote for me, but there's a whole lot of people out there who do believe in God, and I don't want to lose them either.
Right. I think this is part of the reason Allison feels as she does. That is, at least in this country, atheists are a small enough group that they don't get any attention for the most part from candidates. They are not selling themselves to atheists as a kind of target audience. It's true based on, you know, every kind of voting database that you look at, that people who are highly religious are very strong in terms of turnout. They vote very regularly, very reliably, and as a result, they get a lot of candidate attention. And I think another thing that came out, I think, when she was talking is, it's one thing for a candidate to mention their religion or to mention a supreme being, so on and so forth. It's not the fact that if I'm an atheist, I feel I can't be represented by someone who believes in God necessarily. Just as I'm a female, I don't necessarily think it takes another female to represent me adequately, or someone of the same race and so forth. So I think it's a lot more complicated than simply looking for a candidate who matches us along demographic characteristics. And certainly we've seen that in the case of Obama's support from African Americans. It isn't the case that someone has to be identical to us in order to represent us effectively, and I think that's a judgment that we have to make independent of those characteristics. But she's absolutely right. You know, when you're part of a very tiny minority, and a minority that isn't known for its political power, you get ignored.
So let's go back to your free consultation you're offering me in my
yes.
presidential run, please. So if I'm an atheist, or I don't believe in the God that they talk about in the debates, what's my job here? Should I keep that quiet? Should I distort that? Should I pretend I believe in something I don't believe in? How do I play that and still be me?
Well, obviously, I wouldn't recommend that you misrepresent yourself, but I would recommend that based on what audience you're talking to, you emphasize certain things and de-emphasize others. And we see that constantly. I mean, no candidate can talk about all possible issues on every possible occasion in which he or she speaks. And for that reason, you talk about the things that you know your audience is interested in, values, and wants to hear. So certainly, if I were talking to a group of atheists, I would emphasize things other than religion. But, you know, in speaking to a group that is formed around religious purposes, you would emphasize, you know, your the parts of their values that you share. This is no different than how we talk to a person who might sit next to us on an airplane. We sit and we chat and look for perceived similarities, common ground that we have in order to have a conversation with them. And I think the candidates do the very same thing, obviously on a much grander scale.
Oh, so that's why I have so much problems on airplanes. Damn! You're a wonderful consultant. Listen, I want to talk about this phenomenon of branding, which is what you kind of addressed indirectly in your answer. First time I heard that word branding, you know, I thought of cattle on a ranch being branded. and I wonder if there are similarities. What is branding? Who wants to tackle that? Howard?
Well, I suppose branding, you know, is the question of what are the attributes, you know, associated with a category. So, like the Democratic Party, what are the attributes associated with the Democratic Party? And Bill Clinton was successful, you know, in 1992 in part because he you know, changed the perception, you know, of the party. It was branded in a different way. And, you know, it's to say that the Republican coalition, you know, is breaking apart, you know, means to say that, it, you know, in some sense, you know, it is being rebranded, you know, and that the elements are being, you know, reshuffled, and some elements are being, you know, elevated to greater prominence and others are, you know, being discarded. And I think branding is important in part because part of the process, you know, of evaluating candidates and voting in elections is identification, right? And the notion right. that, you know, the candidate, you know, feels the way I feel, understands who I am, in part, you know, is communicated through the notion or the process of identification. You know, and so some creating some sort of lifelike lifelike set of attributes that voters can identify with. Is crucial to winning elections.
Which brings us to the issue, I think, of likability. I mean, Huckabee got a big boost with likability in Obama, and that was probably a major factor in the 2000 election with George Bush. He was seen as a nice guy.
Well, likability is important, I think, in every election. I think you're right that elections are different, and that in 2000 it was a rather politically, quiescent period. We were at peace, there was prosperity, and likability, was perceived to dominate, the election. Bush was the kind of guy you'd like to have a beer with. This was the sort of, going, idea, and that, Gore was stiff and, uninteresting, and possibly dishonest. But likability is always important, and Hillary Clinton is, her candidacy is now, I think, turning on the question of likability. In fact, Charlie Gibson, in that debate on Saturday night, explicitly asked her about, why is she not likable, which I thought was a possibly, over the line, thing to ask. And that, I think, is, something that is partly a question of, gender. Women are expected to be nurturant. Men are expected to be, agentic. Hillary is clearly, well, I wouldn't say that, she clearly possesses the opposite characteristics, but she clearly is perceived to possess the opposite set of characteristics. And, when gender stereotypic expectations are violated, that typically produces, decreases likability.
Diana, your thoughts on that?
I think that's true, but I think it's also the case that it's not, it makes it harder for a woman, no doubt, but it's also true that, she does not go out of her way to be the beer drinking kind of guy. And so, there are different reasons people might support candidates. It's not always the case that we're looking for someone a lot like us or a regular person. Sometimes we're looking for somebody we see as having greater expertise than we do, someone we can trust. And so I think likability is important, but I don't think that's the be-all, end-all here. I don't think it's the only thing going on. And I think, I didn't see that particular question get asked, but yes, it is. It's very peculiar.
Well,
it relates to, I think, the issue of positive emotion toward the candidate. And, there's work in political science and in social psychology suggesting that people and candidates, in election context, who engender enthusiasm, which I think is driven to a large extent, by emotion-related likability, produce more political participation. So a candidate like Obama, who appears to be, more inspirational, mm-hmm. may generate more enthusiasm, is likely to turn out a greater number of voters.
Well, I've got to tell you, Diane, for your sake, since you didn't see it, when he did tell her about the polls or ask her about the polls where she wasn't seen as likable, her response was, "That hurt me," that hurts. But she said it kind of tongue in cheek, and I think she would have done very well if she said it more honestly.
I think that's absolutely true, because first of all, yes, it does hurt. Of course, it does. These people are not different from ordinary human beings. No one wants to be perceived as unlikable, and I'm sure it does hurt. And it isn't. It would do her, a big favor to be seen as vulnerable in that sense, just like anyone else is. I think you can be other things other than likable and have that be enough to win. But the idea that somehow you're so invincible that wouldn't hurt is just improbable. It makes you seem non-human.
Well, my take on Hillary's response, really, Dan, was quite the opposite. I thought that she was, honestly dismayed, and that I think that response helped her.
That's interesting.
And I think the question was such a difficult question.
Yeah.
And she's been in other debates, in other contexts, where she was asked very difficult questions that seem to encroach, you know, on issues that perhaps were, you know, across the line. And so I think that may have been a helpful moment.
It's very personal. I mean, it's one of those questions that strikes at, you know, who we are as human beings, as opposed to, you know, why is your stance on this issue X instead of Y? And I think that shows people at their most vulnerable.
Yeah. Let's take a break. There's lots of other things I want to make sure we touch on, and we've got lots of callers who want to join the conversation. We're talking about politics today, who we like, why we like them, how they brand themselves, and how that works. My guests are Diana Mutz. She's a professor of political science and communications at Penn, and Howard Levine. He's an associate professor of political science and psychology at State University of New York in Stony Brook. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
With Iowa out of the way, but not forgotten, the candidates descend on New Hampshire to build on gains made or recover from damage done. I'm Ron Elving. Join me later today for the next Republican and Democratic debates of the election season. Special coverage of the New Hampshire presidential debates on NPR News.
Tonight at 8 o'clock on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
She likes to dress up and have fun.
Hillary Clinton in bunny slippers?
Yes, I am. That's me with shorter hair and Hillary.
Clinton supporters hope showing off an old photo album will boost her presidential campaign.
Since the Iowa caucuses, some candidates are trying new tactics.
Can they get out the vote for the New Hampshire primary?
It's difficult not to like them once you actually know them.
Find out next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking politics, presidential politics. My guests are Howard Levine and Diane Mutz. Levine's an associate professor of political science at State University in New York at Stony Brook. Mutz is a University of Pennsylvania professor of political science and communications. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Steve on the line. Steve, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to ask about likability and electability. It seems to me a lot of voters base their vote on a candidate which will tell them everything's going to be fine. They want simple answers from a grandfatherly or a fatherly figure. And, for example, Carter got kind of beat up for saying there's a malaise. It's for acknowledging that there was even a problem. President Bush is saying, oh, yes, we can have a war and we can have lower taxes, too. And in a way, to me, I guess that's what Obama's saying. Everything's going to be all right. And that seems to me what voters want to hear. It's sort of like a fantasy in psychological terms. And I'd like to hear your guests talk about that.
Well,
maybe.
Do you mind getting a little personal here? Have you heard anybody running in the primaries who is being more honest than that?
Well, I think more honest politicians have this likability problem. I think that's one of the problems with Hillary or somebody like Joe Biden, or even Kerry last time around, saying these are complex problems. And I think candidates who sort of acknowledge that and talk about complexity, Gore, too, kind of get into trouble because they acknowledge the complexity of things.
That is interesting. So let's hear a response. Howard, Diana?
I agree with Steve's impression. You know, look at what happened with Mondale in 1984. You know, he said, look, we're going to have to raise taxes. And my opponent, Ronald Reagan, wouldn't acknowledge that that was the case. Of course, Reagan did raise taxes in the second term, and, you know, good thing that he did. And, you know, there are many examples, I think. You know, I think there are two things, right? One is optimism and the other is complexity, and I think the voters, you know, like the first and dislike the second, and, you know, politics doesn't rate, you know, that highly on the interest scales of most people, and I think having to think, you know, deeply and at length, you know, through a political, you know, debate, you know, is just not something voters, you know, are willing to do or enjoy doing, at least a great, great many of them. So I think that, you know, the notion you know, that there's a certain, you know, sort of autistic quality, you know, to, you know, the mass public is, you know, not one that is entirely off base.
So I, I, I heard one person say to me that I wouldn't believe that even if it was true. Diana, at a certain level, do we want to be told what we want to be told, whether it's accurate or not?
Well, I think, you know, Howard is right about people liking optimism and disliking being dragged through the complexities of government, but I also think that there's a self-selection process that goes on that produces the candidates that we have. That is, you've got to be somewhat of an optimist to want to be president of a country if you think it's truly, you know, going to hell in a handbasket and going to be irreparable mess. It's not a position you'd be seeking. So these are people who I think truly do believe that they can do something valuable, that they can change things for the better. They're optimists, and they believe what they're saying.
So we need an optimist, but it's the cockeyed optimist that we want to try to...
Right. Obviously, there is a difference between, oh, we can have everything, sacrifice nothing, and that sort of thing is not very plausible. But I do think that, you know, relative to the population at large, what you've got here is a group of very optimistic people, very, you know, not at all representative necessarily of the levels of optimism of the mass public, and they are leaders partly for that reason.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Atik on the line. I hope I was somewhat okay with your name.
Yeah, it's Atik.
Atik.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently became a U.S. citizen. Originally, I'm from Pakistan. And this will be my first election participation. I'm really enjoying it.
Wonderful.
And the issue that most important for me is the foreign policy. And I think the Republicans really scare me because they are very using fear to get more votes, and I will vote for Democrat, and among Democrats I prefer Obama than Hillary, because Hillary supported Iraq war initially, which I totally not agree with. So that will make my decision, the foreign policy, basically.
So domestic policy is in the distance second for you.
It is important also, especially the social issues, because I'm a gay man also, and I don't, on that part, I don't like Republicans there because they are conservative, and so I prefer Democrats. But I think for me, foreign policy is more important because thousands of people are dying because of our wrong policies and bad decisions, which should be...
And what is it Obama has said or done that gives you confidence that he will change the way we do foreign policy?
I like Obama because he is not a Washington insider. Hillary is almost, for me, a continuation of Bush policy, and she has a lot of connection with big interest groups, and I think lack of experience of Obama is kind of a good thing for me.
Okay. All right. Well, let's turn to the experts, and thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
So what I hear from Atik is, certainly it's understandable, but I've heard a lot of the language of pundits as he describes the candidates, their strong points and their weak points. So the language of pundits does get into our heads.
It does. I mean, you know, we are, you know, influenced to a large extent by the media. You know, it's hard to experience, you know, any live contact with much of, you know, the political world. And so the language that we use is often directly taken, at least from partisan elites that we trust. And certainly the parties will frame using different language, you know, issues to their partisan benefit. I think just, you know, responding to Atik's preference for Obama and his concern for foreign policy, Obama does appear to have more credibility on the issue of the Iraq war. You know, his, you know, two major opponents, Edwards and Clinton, both voted for the war, and so he has been touting, you know, the idea that, you know, he was right about this and that his judgment is better, you know, than, you know, is, for example, Senator Clinton's, who has been touting, you know, experience. And so I think it's not just about change versus experience, but in the foreign policy domain, it's judgment versus experience. And I think that's something that you know, Hillary had a lot of trouble with, at least among liberal Democrats, for quite some time.
Yeah, if I can add, I think the language of strategy and tactics of political consultants and so forth has really become the language of the news media as well. I couldn't help but notice during the brief break that we took, there was a little teaser about Hillary releasing a photo album and would this work to change voters' perceptions of her and so forth. And so, you know, even on NPR, when politics is covered, it's about whether or not doing, you know, a particular action will influence other people, not about the substance of the actual event and that sort of thing. And I think that's everybody's language these days. There isn't, you know, the whole idea of branding and so forth being in the popular parlance means that we're all talking about in those terms, not just academics, not just pollsters and political consultants and so forth. So we're all looking at it as sort of third-party consultants.
And it may be consultants and party operatives that are driving the language ultimately, right? Because the parties are framing, you know, issues using words, you know, that work. You know, there are a number of books. Frank Luntz's book, Words That Work, It's Not What You Say, It's What People Hear, I think is a very good example of a research strategy that looks at, you know, the network of emotional associations associated with words that can be used to, you know, construct policy platforms. And the media, you know, tend to adopt the language used by campaigns. So, for example, the war on terror, you know, has, you know, implications that redound better to the Republican than Democratic, you know, party in terms of, you know, owning the issue of, you know, fear and terror and foreign policy generally.
I've got to tell you, with that point, you just opened another hour show that we could do. Because I'd love to do a show on language and politics. Unfortunately, we don't have time. The only thing we have time to do today is to say goodbye to the two of you and to thank you for joining us. I think it's been a fascinating show.
Thanks for having me.
My guests have been Howard Levine and Diana Mutz. Levine's an associate professor of political science and psychology at State University in New York in Stony Brook. Mutz is director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Political Science at Annenberg. And you can visit WHYY.org for more Election 2008 coverage. And you can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Gita Simons helped production of today's show. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Lisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Have a good week, my friends.
Day to day.